Before we get to illegal drug use and maybe addiction, should we start with why people start using drugs in the first place? Or is that a decent place to start? Or what do you say?
Sure, that's a reasonable place. It's an interesting question, right? So, and you know, to sort of back up a bit, you know, we think of drugs as they're good drugs and they're bad drugs, right? And so when we take medicines, those are good drugs, and you know, a doctor gives them to us and they help us with our problems, and both physical and mental, if we're in pain or something like this. And then there are these bad drugs, and the bad drugs are the illegal ones. And what's interesting is that, you know, they're only made illegal because we decide as a society to make them that way, right? There's nothing in particular about the drugs, illegal or legal, that make them any different. Illegal drugs tend to be more dangerous because they aren't regulated like legal drugs. But of course, legal medications can be also very dangerous and cause all kinds of problems. So why do people use them? It's a really good question, and there's been a lot of research trying to figure out, well, why would someone use these substances? And unfortunately, the answer to that question is very complicated. They can use drugs for lots of different reasons. One of the most important, however, is that these drugs are very effective at making people feel good. So, you know, I talk to my students sometimes about this, and I've asked people in my research, well, why did they start using? And it's very complicated for them to explain, primarily because a lot of times they don't know. They might just try it out. You know, a friend might be using something and they just say, hey, try this, it's fun. A lot of times the reasons are really benign. They aren't really sort of a strong reason, if you want to think of it that way. Or people might just be bored. You know, there's been a long literature about human beings as a sort of a species, or sort of wanting to alter their reality. And so these drugs are very good at doing that, especially illegal drugs, because they tend to be more potent than legal versions of the same drug. And so, you know, that's sort of been sort of discussed as well, as sort of people want to change their perceptions. That's why we drink. That's why we smoke cigarettes, you know, sort of, and those have effects on our brain. So
I want to understand a little bit more on the good drugs / bad drugs, in the sense, part of it feels like a social construct. Like, I mean, I think you also alluded to it that, you know, there are, we as a society, we come to a conclusion that, you know, this drug, like nicotine is fine, but cocaine is not.
Right.
So are these, do you think these distinctions are arbitrary, or there is actually, you know, so just to maybe take a step back as well. So I was talking about this to my friend as well. So I'm generally pro legalization of all drugs, including like the very hard ones. But my friend was talking to me about how cocaine, he was telling me that I have never used cocaine. And so I don't know the effects that cocaine can have on me, and how it goes on to destroy my entire family, my savings, etc. So, so are these distinctions arbitrary, or do you think there is actually a good reason where, you know, nicotine is fine, actually fine, and cocaine should definitely be banned? So how should we think about it?
Yeah, it's a really complicated question that you're asking, but a good one and an important one. I do believe they are social constructs to some degree, right? We decide what to make legal as a society and illegal, or what we decide to stigmatize or not stigmatize might be a better way to think about it. But these substances themselves are dangerous in some capacity, right? So, for example, fentanyl, which is the problematic drug now, in fact, just here in Cleveland over the weekend, there were, I think, 19 fatalities, which was really unusual. And so, you know, there are problems that people have with drugs that cause them pain and suffering over their life. And that is not, it's not made up. It's not a social construct. you know, it's very hard to use these drugs and maintain sort of a normal existence. That being said, people that I work with who use drugs every day are often very functional. They have, you know, they have thoughts of the future, they have families, they have friends. And so there is a lot of, it's challenging to put all drugs in the same box, right? So, and if you think about the United States, we have basically 51 drug policies, 50 for all the states, and then we have federal drug policy. And so we make things illegal based on sometimes the wills of the citizens, right? So in Colorado and in Oregon and lots of other places, marijuana, for example, is legal. And you can use it recreationally, but in other states you can't. And so there is some of that going on, but I don't want to say that using these drugs are without consequence. And I've been asked about the legal question, sort of should sort of quote unquote hard drugs be legalized, cocaine and heroin or sort of opiates. And, you know, I think that's a hard one for me. I've seen a lot of people really struggle with addiction. Cocaine is a good example. Cocaine is a great drug. It makes people feel very good. Methamphetamine is a good drug if you want to get a lot of work done, or amphetamines in general. But do we want to use them for those purposes or allow people to sort of freely use the drugs in that way? I'm not sure that policy-wise that makes sense either. What I do think makes sense is that if people decide to use the drugs, we shouldn't criminalize their behavior, and we should offer them help if they want to change, you know, what they're using. You know, it's ironic that the two drugs I don't talk about in my class, nicotine and alcohol, are the biggest worldwide killers by far, by a long shot. And nicotine, you know, there's nowhere where smoking is illegal. Now, it might be restricted in lots of ways, but that's the number one killer. So,
is there a reason you don't talk about those drugs in your class?
I stick to the illegal ones, really. You know, I think if I opened it up to alcohol and nicotine, they're almost in a different class when it comes to research and sort of policy and things like that, which is also interesting to think about. They're acceptable, right? You can drink alcohol in the U.S. and it's a completely acceptable thing. You can smoke a cigarette and people might, you know, think ill of you, but you can still do it. You can't snort a line of cocaine or inject heroin, right? So those are the drugs I focus on.
Is there, so since these are illegal drugs, this might be a generic question, but in the sense that, is there any fascination because it's illegal? Do you think is there any relation between like that these drugs being illegal and people's fascination towards them? Like, is there a factor or do you think that's overblown?
Well, you know, when you think so, if you think about the people who start using drugs, and this has changed to some degree in various times in U.S. history during different epidemics, but most people that start using drugs are young people. And young people like to take risks. They like to have a good time. They feel invincible. And so, that goes into sort of the thinking when people are using these substances. And the fact that they're forbidden by, you know, adults, right? They can't be used. So it's like alcohol, right? When you're a kid, you really want to try alcohol because you see all the adults using it or whatever. And so I think there's some of that going on as well. But yeah.
A personal revelation in the sense that I have wanted to try cocaine. But for me, the biggest issue in maybe trying it out was affordability. So one is accessibility and one is affordability. I've never been to the US, so I don't know, maybe you can speak to the US case. In India, it's very difficult in general to access these, I wouldn't even know like who to call. And also in India, I think at least as per my friends and people have spoken about this, it's ridiculously expensive. Yeah. So could you speak to the accessibility and / affordability part? Like if a student or if a teenager in, let's say, New York or any random city in the US wanted to try something, how easy is it for them to access and how affordable is it?
Yeah. It's a good question. So those two questions vary greatly, but by the geographic location, right? So even within the U.S., there are big variations on what drugs people can access easily. So in bigger cities, they have open-air drug markets. I'm sure you've seen them on TV, right? People can walk into those areas and try to buy drugs. It's not advisable, but they can do that. And so and that's sort of been the image of the drug market. The research that I do is actually on trying to rethink that structure, in that a lot of the people that I work with, they get drugs initially from their friends. Their friends buy drugs for them. So, you know, we call this brokering. The person acts as a broker to buy drugs for someone who doesn't have access to them. And if you include those interactions within the drug market, then drugs become extremely accessible to people who have relationships with other people who use drugs. Now, you might not know who those people are in your social network, right? You know, but I can guarantee you there's someone that you know that's using drugs. And so if you're really interested, right, that's how a lot of people make their contact. Now, affordability is the other issue. Now, drugs in the U.S. Tend to be inexpensive by the unit. So you can buy like a $10 bag of heroin or a $10 rock of cocaine. But what happens is that people don't just use one rock of cocaine or, a small bag. They'll very quickly escalate their use to multiple bags. And that's where it gets very expensive very quickly. And people sometimes turn to crime. There's lots of ways they're turning to crime. It's mostly things like shoplifting. But a lot of the people that I work with have jobs and they work. So they just spend their money on drugs. So, yeah.
How much of this aspect of, you try it once and you're kind of sold for a lifetime. How much of that is a factor?
Yeah, so this is another challenging element of drug education, is that in the U.S., it's very common that that the law enforcement officer will come and give students in high school education about illegal drug use. And what they'll say is that if you try it once, you'll get addicted or you might overdose and die. And for the most part, that's not true. It takes repetitive use to become actually addicted, in the sense that your body becomes accustomed to the substance, and if you don't use it, you would get sick, which is withdrawal. But that's only happens for some drugs. What does happen is you get into how the feeling, and you want that feeling again. And so sometimes people will use repeatedly, because one of the things about illegal drugs that is true is that they are very good at their job. They make people feel really good, and that's reinforcing. So it's challenging in educating young people about drugs, because it's not true that if you smoke marijuana once, you're going to become addicted to it. In fact, you can use cocaine once and you're not becoming addicted to it. However, there is a risk that you might want to repeat those experiences because of the reinforcing nature of how the drugs make you feel.
So feel good are two words which have repeatedly entered our discussion till now. Is it fair to say that it's the biggest, it's like the biggest motivator, or are there other reactions of the drug that it might induce people to constantly go look for them?
Sure. Well, so in my class, I go through the different classes of drugs. So the different types of drugs. So there's stimulants, there are depressants, there are opiates. And There are psychedelics, right? So drugs do different things. And so, for example, we're doing a study right now on why people are using psychedelic magic mushrooms, right? So, and some people are using them because it helps them process trauma, or some mental illness or some challenges they have. Other people use them because they're fun and they kind of get into some interesting thoughts and things like this. Other people are using them because it helps them empathize as a businessman with their employees. So this is the same for almost all drugs, is that there are multiple reasons and motives. So for example, with methamphetamines, people use them to get high, but people also use them to work long hours and not go to sleep, right? So there are various benefits, for pain medications that, those opiates block pain, but they also sort of give you a sort of a numbness that's sort of pleasurable as well. So there are multiple sort of outcomes that might be a motive for people's use.
Are young people like the most, are in the category who are most in risk to try these and also to be addicted to them? Or like the way I'm contrasting this is like, I feel once you get into the job market or once you're earning, I feel like you have a lot of resources to maybe spend on like to buy. And also this is also influenced by my pop culture viewing as well. Like I recall like Wolf of Wall Street and these hedge fund guys and where they have so much money and they're willing to spend it on these activities. So could you maybe, any comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting sort of idea that, young people are most at risk because they're the highest risk takers by age category. But that doesn't necessarily mean that they're the only ones who start using drugs. Crack cocaine is a good example of that, and that during the crack epidemic in the U.S., it was actually older people in their 20s and 30s who were starting to use the drug. And they were using it to help them work, to have a good time, to party. You mentioned the Wolf of Wall Street. That's a good example of that. Go, 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 80s. Cocaine just became part of the drug scene that people were sort of makes people feel really good. And the 80s were about making people feel good. And so I think that there are trends that way as well, where, there are. I mean, I wouldn't say it's just young people, but young people, I think, are pose the biggest challenge when it comes to people starting to use drugs.
You mentioned, the go, go, go of 80s. Like, how do you think, I'm just trying to understand the cultural, like when certain types of drugs enter like the cultural the cultural domain, or in the sense like everybody's kind of talking about it. So like what I'm curious about is, partly I feel like my intuition is like, there is this Wall Street culture that they have, and it's very specific to, let's say, investment banking. And, because these guys make so much money, they're able to, they have disposable income and they're able to spend that money on maybe on drugs. But also the culture of working at an investment bank also kind of encourages you to take part in like long hours that would require drugs. And, so you're like part of that system. But I'm also curious about where it enters like the day-to-day street activities, where like even a teenager or even an average person would be interested in, let's say, buying, or at least has that knowledge of that crime culture or that drugs culture per se. So could you comment on like how does that, like when does a drug probably enter like the cultural domain, or where people are kind of talking about it and it's everywhere? Sorry, it's a bit unclear question, but yeah.
No, it's a tricky one. So we can use the example of ecstasy as a good example. So ecstasy had been around for a long, long time in the United States during the 80s in sort of bars, and people were using it, but it wasn't really all that popular. But as sort of the rave and the sort of the dance culture sort of exploded in Europe and then later into the US and I don't know, all around the world, people realized that this was sort of a perfect drug for that environment, right? And sort of there's a whole culture that evolved around the drug within those settings. So sometimes drugs meet the needs of groups that are looking to enhance their experiences in this way. Other times, you can imagine, for example, among very poor people, that they might just want an escape from their lives. I talk about this in my class, is that, you know, a lot of people work really hard and they don't make a lot of money. And who's to say on the weekend that if they go to the bar and maybe have a drink and snort a line of cocaine, or maybe they, you know, that just makes them feel better about their life. So, you know, so it runs the range of sometimes drugs are attracted or sort of work within the environment. And sometimes, you know, the environment supports the use. So, you know, so there's sort of a cycle there, which I think is interesting to think about.
I want to go back to the feel good. I want to go back to that feel good part again, in the sense that. So let me take a step back in the sense. Society wise, or maybe like cultural conversations wise, I feel the general sentiment is drugs are bad and illegal drugs are very bad. So, but we also spoke about how people might like that aspect of feeling good, and that's why they kind of take those drugs as well. But do we have any data on, obviously, initially I do feel good. So like one example I can share is maybe alcohol. So alcohol definitely feels good when you're consuming it, but the next day effects are probably like it's absolutely horrible. Like going through a hangover is probably it's extremely bad. Do we know anything about like long-term satisfaction of even though I think people would have you believe that obviously everybody regrets using them and everybody does not have a good time using them, is there a contrary view that, you know, maybe they do enjoy using it, and even the long-term effects, they're satisfied with the use per se? So any comments on that?
Yeah, you know, it's the kind of research that you're thinking about is very hard to do, right? So, but I can tell you from personal experiences having interviewed. So in my work, I interview a lot of people who have used drugs for many, many, many years. So, and when I mean many years, I mean maybe 40 or 50 years worth of use. And but very rapidly, what I find is that even after a couple of years of use, people are exhausted by it. It is really hard to maintain a lifestyle in which you are using drugs, illegal drugs, every day or every other day. It's hard on you economically. It's hard on your family. You have to find the money. You have to find the space in your day to do it. You have to sort of work all of those things out. And a lot of people get exhausted by it. And in fact, some people quit using illegal drugs because they just want a break. They just want a time out from it. And so I think that initially what happens is, hey, this is fun. You know, like you said, with alcohol. But over time, you know, the effects wear people out, and very rapidly, you know, especially when people get into the sort of the heavy use and they're using daily, it's really hard on people. The challenge, of course, is that a lot of you say, well, why don't you just use it on the weekend then? And that's how a lot of times it starts, right? It's just on the weekend, or maybe just I'll use it at this party, but you know what? Hey, you know what? Maybe I'll use a little bit more. It makes me feel good. And soon enough, they're using every day, and their lives changing. And it doesn't take long for those patterns to change. And then it becomes a job. Then it's a job, just like any other job. So this scenario of this
rational person using a drug as a competitive advantage over his peers, or maybe just to keep him or herself on the edge, or maybe mentally very sharp by moderate use. So those cases are just fiction. I mean, in a sense, it's very hard to implement those cases. Is that fair?
Well, I mean, I think that people do that. We did a study a while ago on sort of these study drugs, right? Using Adderall, for students using Adderall during finals and things like this. And, you know, that's popular. It's, you know, it happens. The challenge, of course, there is you think, well, you know, they shouldn't have an advantage, and maybe we should just make the drug over the counter if it benefits everybody, because it seems to do that. But then you have to say, okay, well, do we want our medical school students taking that, or our law school students taking that, or then our doctors to maintain these edges? You know, I think that's where it gets a little bit dicey ethically, right? So
you used words like, you know, they want to time out, they're tired, it takes a toll. Even though, I mean, we didn't start the discussion on addiction per se, but if I can jump ahead a little bit, in the sense, do they use that as an out, in the sense, do they use that as a way to, you know, enough of this, like, this is just too tiring and I'm just going to quit. Does that happen, or is it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it does. Absolutely. So sometimes people just done with it, right? Sometimes people go to treatment and you know, they do sort of the traditional route where they hit rock bottom or whatever is the sort of the narrative, and then they go into treatment, and then they're in recovery. But a lot of times it doesn't happen that way. Sometimes they're just tired and they just stop using and on their own. And so it's really it depends on the drug, but once you have the substance use disorder is what we're talking about, and I don't like to use the word addiction because that's stigmatizing, but once you have substance use disorder, it's chronic and it's very hard to stop. So that's the challenge, especially with drugs like opiates that you become physically addicted to, and if you stop them, you become sick, right? So you'll go into withdrawal. That's like alcohol. That's very challenging for people.
You mentioned you don't want to say addiction because it stigmatizes them. How should we be thinking about addiction, and how should we be talking about addiction?
Yeah, it's a good question. There have been changes in the language over the last, I would say, maybe 10 years, where we don't talk about addiction. We talk about people with substance use disorder or opiate use disorder to try to lessen that burden of stigma. We don't talk about drug users. We talk about people who use drugs. That's the sort of the common language, because user, again, is sort of stigmatizing. We don't talk about people getting clean when they go into drug treatment. We talk about them being in recovery. So there's lots of language to try to lessen those the attitudes that we have that get presented through the language.
Does the language matter, though? I mean, how big of a role does that play?
It does, for sure, for people who are in these conditions, you know, calling them an addict. So you have to remember that the people that are who have substance use disorder and are using drugs every day, they are burdened with this idea, this moral notion of addiction, right? So the challenge is that morally we see illegal drug use as bad or wrong, and so we project that people who are using these substances are bad people or aren't smart, or, you know, they have some problem. And the people themselves internalize that. And so once we use things like user or addict, that just further separates them from being everyday people, which would in turn challenge them to become, to go into treatment and recovery. So,
my thoughts on this.
Self-stigmatizing is the term for that. Yeah. Sorry.
I mean, my thoughts are a bit muddled here, in the sense that so the way I'm thinking about this is, one element is, like, obviously, I think as an average person, I will not do like a lot of analysis. Like, as an average person, or I don't know, as myself, I think I'll just directly come to conclusion, or if I see somebody using, I'll suddenly in my mind, I'm just like, addict. Or, you know, I don't go to, I will not take the extra effort to you know, consider what their life circumstances, what their history is. I'll be like, I don't care. He's using, he's an addict for me, and I'll move on. Second, another way, what I'm trying to get at is like, so there, when I made that snap judgment, I kind of viewed it as a choice where person X had a choice of either leading a life without consuming drugs or with consuming drugs. And I assumed that he made a choice, and that's why whatever happens to him, I don't care. Is it fair to look at it that way? Or the best example I can think of is like gambling. I don't know. Or is it like gambling where you don't due to various reasons, you end up, gambling, and, you know, maybe it's not in control? Or should we also, are there genetic components to this? Is it like any kind of other disease which has a genetic component to it, and the person is just a channel, and, you know, is an output of these genetic variations and mutations? So could you,
Yeah, that's another challenging issue, right? So to answer your first question first, and I talk about this in my class because I think it's an important way that we are socialized about the use of illegal drugs and substance use disorder, is that we see it as a choice. And because they choose, then they've made a bad choice, they should be punished. And so it reinforces this notion that they need to be removed from society or changed or some other way. So, but if you imagine substance use disorder as a mental disorder, you know, where people become addicted over time, and, you know, it's not going to happen to everybody. I'm not sure the choice is, it's not a choice anymore. If you imagine a person has to use a pill or use a drug to feel normal, I'm not sure that that's the right sort of framework.
I'm really sorry. Can you please repeat that, please?
So let's imagine for a minute that a person becomes addicted to opioids. So when you use, and this happens over the course of 3 days. Let's say you break your arm and you go into the hospital, and the doctor gives you pills, and you come home and you take the pills because you're in pain. But you know what? You take them a little bit longer because they kind of make you feel better in general. Well, after 3 days of consistent use, if you stop using those pills, you're going to feel sick. You're going to be sick. And so you're motivated to continue to use the pills to feel better. At that point, I'm not sure if you're choosing, is what I'm saying. You're sort of choosing to feel like you should because the drugs have altered what that normal is to you. So
if I can push back on that analogy, but I'll take a different, in the medical setting, I'm completely sold. I agree with you, but in a street setting, I'm not very sold. Is that fair? In the sense that I'm making that.
Well, let's go back to the medical. So this is what happened during the opiate epidemic, is that it was a medical setting. So now people are using the pills, and because they've been given to them by a doctor, but they aren't satisfying their withdrawal. And so they have to find something at that point to do it, or they're going to be incapacitated. Now, for illegal drugs, I think it's a little bit different because it happens more subtly. So you go to a party, let's say we can use cocaine if you'd like. You use cocaine in a party two or three times, and you become dependent on how it makes you feel in some ways to make you social or interacting with other people. It gives you a lift. When you don't take it, your mood is low. So, you know, taking it, you know, is a choice, of course. You don't have to take it. But if you don't take it, there are consequences that you realize might be negative. And so I'm not sure, all I'm saying is that I'm not sure it's a choice in the way that we imagine a regular choice for, hey, I want a soda or I want orange juice, right? So, you know, I think there's challenges to that whole idiom of choice here to some degree, even though it is a choice. You know, ultimately you're choosing this, but you're choosing it in a way that, you know, where it's rational to actually choose to use, if you want to think of it in a different way.
How much of this is I want to touch on the medical angle a little bit. So in the sense that A lot of the examples that we have kind of spoken up until now, I feel like have been like feel good students using it for maybe experimentation, some level of productivity usage. And also last example was like being a little free in the sense that being socially more, if I can use the word free, I don't know, like being more social. Yeah. Are those like the dominant cases, or in the sense that, or is the medical case undersold, or is the medical, is there not huge, initially you did allude to like, you know, for trauma, it can be helpful. So I'm just trying to understand like, you know, what are the medical aspects to this? And I'm sure, I think other various drugs will have various components, I mean, various roles to play at different diseases as well. I don't know. So if you can maybe comment on that.
Yeah, you know, once again, it's a little bit complicated because if you think about medicine, right, that a doctor gives you, you imagine, well, that's safe for starters. Illegal drugs are not safe in the way, same way, right, as legal medications. But they operate on the same neurological pathways. And so, you know, if you're using codeine, you know, it's the same essential pathway as heroin, right? They're both opiates. And so it's, we want to allow doctors the freedom to give patients medicine for pain, right? But when the patient is taking those medicines and becomes sort of addicted to them in this way that we've talked about, or dependent on them, then that's not good, right? So there's this, they sort of switch. This is this notion of drug, the misuse of drugs. And I talk about this in my class, and that when we talk about drug misuse can be lots of things. Let's say you have leftover medication and you use it, you know, because you have a headache, right? That's misuse, but that happens a lot in the U.S. because, you know, you might have a prescription.
How is that a misuse? I didn't understand that actually. How is that a misuse?
Well, it's not prescribed for that indication, right? So let's say that you break your arm and you get a bottle of codeine, or you go in for tooth surgery or something and they give you a bottle of 50 codeine because afterwards you're going to be in pain. And you use maybe 3 or 4 of them, but you aren't really feeling any pain. So now you have a bottle of, I don't know, 30 codeine. And now let's say 2 weeks later, you have a headache. Well, maybe you take that medicine that's not prescribed for a headache, but you know, it makes you feel good and makes the pain go away. That's misuse. And that happens a lot. So not just with codeine, but Prozac or whatever, you know, Adderall, right? You know, you can imagine that happening with lots of different medicines. And so that's misuse. You're not supposed to do that. So
this is somewhat reminding me of the Sackler controversy. I don't know.
Yeah.
We discussed like talking about addiction. I want to touch on, so one is talking about addiction, but also one is like implicitly learning about these things, may not be addiction per se, but like about these illegal drugs. I'm alluding to like pop culture references and like how I feel like most of the education that like an average person gets, at least I got like most of the things I know about drugs from Breaking Bad or The Wire or some of these shows. And so that is one part where you get to know like, you know, this is a badass thing to do, and you know, this is like a criminal thing to do, and you also get to know what like some of the names of like, you know, heroin and cocaine, apparently they're the bad ones, they're the really bad ones. But also, so that is one part. Second part, I was also thinking about in music as well. I feel that there's a glorification of drug use, like in the sense that a lot of the lyrics will allude to, I don't know, I got codeine and then, you know, sipping on a bottle of codeine. You know, some things, I don't know much of the rap music, but or, you know, maybe pop music as well. But there seems to be a large number of references to drugs and drug use and glorification of it. Like, you know, it's cool. It's a cool thing to do. And yeah. So any comments on that? How are you thinking about
that? Yeah, so we do, so I do in my class, I actually do this sort of media study where I have the students select a group of media about drug use. Now, it can be lots of different things. It could be songs, or it could be video clips, right, from a movie, or it could be TV episodes or streaming episodes like Euphoria, right, and HBO. Lots and lots of drug use. We see a lot of drug use in the media. Now, there are some challenges because when you look or when you think about the messages in the media about drug use, a lot of times they are not accurate. So, for example, I'll just give you a quick one, is that anytime you see people buying and selling drugs in the movies or the TV, right, there's always violence, there's always guns, someone's getting shot, someone's getting, you know, robbed or something like that. Well, I can tell you because of personal experience, I worked with two heroin dealers for about 18 months straight, and there wasn't one instance of violence. Now, that doesn't mean that it wasn't a violent scene, right? There's a lot of intimidation there. There's a lot of sort of, you know, innuendo, but there's no shoot 'em up gun violence that you see in the TV. Now, that doesn't mean that it doesn't happen, but what I'm saying is that when you see that every single time on the TV about drug use, you just make assumptions that this is a violent scene. And so there are lots and lots of narratives like this that you see in the media. For example, we've talked about this a little bit before. People have to hit rock bottom before they go into drug treatment, and then they recover and they become new people. That almost never happens, but that's the movie narrative, right? So this is problematic for people because that's how most everybody learns about drug use. They don't take classes in it, you know, they don't. You know, that's what they know. So, and that's problematic. So.
Have you watched Euphoria?
I have seen Euphoria, yeah.
So I have to, I mean, maybe a digression, but I have to take your, I mean, I have to ask you, in the sense that I watched maybe two episodes, I don't recall, but I remember hating the show, really hating the show. Like, I could not, so this may be due to various reasons. Partly, I'm not an American, so I don't know how US school system works. So I was trying to juxtapose juxtapose Euphoria and the school that they were in to the richest school in India, or maybe the most expensive school in India. And even then, I could not think of an issue where, you know, you would have such amount of like rampant drug use. Remove that and only consider the US, I don't know. It just felt very for me, it was just unimaginable that there would be a school like, you know, the one shown in Euphoria where the situation would be that bad. Maybe it is my ignorance, and it may be that I have really no experience or I have no idea what I'm talking about. Maybe if that is the case, maybe you can point to it. But what did you think of the show on the way that addiction and drug use was depicted in the show? Any comments, please?
Well, for that show, I think they're fairly brutal with the depiction of drug use and the problems that it ends up causing people on the show. This is, I think, indicative of the media, however, is that they tend to amplify, right? They're always going to amplify and make things much more scary, invoke much more of an emotional response than is going to that reality, you know, than reality. And so there are, I think, there's a lot of drug use in high school. My daughter goes to high school in a private high school, and she tells me that there's drug use there. It's not like Euphoria, but there are instances in which, you know, these things happen. And so I don't know that it's not real. I wouldn't say that it's not real, but I would say that it's, and it is exaggerated to some degree, but those are probably, those stories aren't impossible to imagine. You know, the one thing, and India is like this too, the U.S. is huge, right? I mean, people don't understand the scale and the scope of the problem in the U.S. It's big. I was recently in Taiwan, and there they have no drug problem there, and it's because they have it's a small place. You know, and so I think that you have to be a little bit careful in depictions that you see in the media on drug use, because they tend to amplify or want to amplify those activities for the sale of the product. But there are, I mean, it's not, you don't have to go far to find documentaries where it's pretty bad stuff that's happening. So I don't know. I think, you know, that's a particular case. You know, there are other drug, there's, you know, there are lots of movies on drug use. Some of them are sort of partially accurate. Some of them are sort of totally outlandish, right? So you have to sort of be careful a little bit. A careful consumer is what I try to make my students when it comes to that kind of stuff. And then you have public service announcements, right? Do you have these in India? I don't know, right? So this is your brain on drugs. They throw an egg in the pan and it's frying and things like that. So
I'm not aware of PSAs in India. I'm not very sure. But on Euphoria, I think I'm just going to continue hating the show. I don't like the show, so I'll just continue.
Yeah. You're free to hate the show. You don't have to like it.
I'm curious in the sense of what movie or TV show that you have seen where you thought it was close to reality as it could probably get without like repelling the audience, or, you know.
The Wire is pretty good. The Wire is good. But The Wire is also very specific, right? You know, to some degree, depicting what drug use is like in a particular environment. Traffic is a good movie. I think it was the 90s with Kurt Douglas. It looks at sort of different elements of the drug problem. That's a good one. You know, there's some that are sort of Cocaine Cowboy is an excellent movie that talks about people stealing pharmaceutical drugs and then using them. That's a very accurate, I think, depiction. There are some that are like that. But they sort of amplify different things, you know, about the problem, I think.
And the most horrible one, or the most like bizarre?
I think, depictions of drug treatment in movies that are completely inaccurate. I haven't really found one that's very accurate, because they all tell this narrative that people recover easily or, you know, from using these substances. And that's just not true. it's very, very, it takes at least four or five times. There are all kinds of challenges, you know, of trying to remain sort of drug-free. Almost any depiction of drug treatment is going to be inaccurate. So I'm trying to think of what else. None to come to mind right off the bat. There are a lot of them are, like I said, they're caricatures. Like Euphoria is kind of a caricature, right? It's taking a problem and it's ramping it up. So
I'm going to turn this into like a movie review system now.
right,
I'm serious actually. But
I actually thought about doing that, trying to list a bunch of movies and then rating them, because the students, they see a lot of, they consume a lot of content, right? And they want to know, well, is this right or is this wrong?
Yeah. Have you watched this movie called 28 Days Later? Oh, sorry, no, not 28 Days Later. I think it's just 28 Days.
Yes, that's one of the ones that we looked at. Yeah, that's the treatment one, right?
Sandra Bullock.
Yeah. That's bad. So, you know, right. So, yeah, so there actually have been a couple of media analyses looking at different themes in the media, which is sort of interesting, you know, on addiction.
But your bottom line is it's a bad movie in a sense, in terms of like depiction-wise. Probably not the best one.
Yeah, I mean, I think that a lot of the movies want to give you a good story, and a one that's kind of hopeful and that has a sort of happy, not a happy, but a positive ending. A lot of the stories are not happy endings from my perspective for the people that I work with. So.
Sorry, one comment on 28 Days is I think you're right in a sense. I really enjoyed the story, and I remember liking the movie a lot. Breaking Bad.
Breaking Bad's a good one. I mean, it sort of depends, right? it's sort of some of them are on sort of Breaking Bad. Breaking Bad's fairly, I think, accurate. I would say it does have some depictions of, yeah, I mean, I think that's a good one. What else? I'm trying to think. A lot of them I just don't watch because I end up analyzing them instead of watching the movie. So because some of them I think are entertaining, it's just what's the messaging you want to think about, right?
I also think like movies where crime is involved and especially drugs are involved end up doing not movies movies and slash TV shows. Which have like illegal drugs as like a plotline, generally tend to do pretty well. And there seems to be like a good, like average people are willing to consume a lot of stuff where there is crime and drugs involved, even though they may not do it themselves. But seeing other people do it seems like a very interesting thing to do.
Right. One of the things you have to realize is that a lot of people use drugs who don't have problems. And so I think they're like, a lot of the people that I work with, they might not even go onto the street to buy drugs. They aren't interacting in those settings. You know, they're having drugs delivered, or they're buying with a person they've known for years. So it's different.
I want to switch gears to consequences. I think earlier you did touch upon like consequences, but so I'll leave this up to you in a sense. Like, how should we think about consequences? Like, in my mind, at least, I'm just like every drug will have, I'm sure, like different consequences that the person has to suffer. I think marijuana will be different and cocaine will have different. So I'll just leave it up to you in the sense which one you want to cover, which one is like very bad, which one is like, okay. So, yeah.
Yeah. So I think consequences, you can look at it in a number of different ways. You can look at it on the individual level, like what happens to a person or their brain, and sort of their body when they're using these drugs over long periods of time. Methamphetamine might be probably the worst. I mean, probably opiates are the worst because you can die at this point because of the drug supply almost any time. You don't have to use a large amount to die.
Define or give us some context on what is opiates? Like, what are opiates?
Yeah, so opiates are things like heroin. They're drugs that are painkillers, basically. Any codeine, of course, OxyContin was the big one by Purdue Pharma that was pushed, but they're painkillers. And they range in potency. So methadone is a good example. Methadone is sometimes used when a person is addicted to try to help them maintain their lifestyle. It's sort of a medicine, but it's also an opiate. So, right now in the U.S. there's illegal fentanyl and carfentanil, and these are extremely potent. As much of a grain of sand can kill a person who's not tolerant to the drug. So those are really, so death is probably, for opiate users is the number one outcome that we need to avoid. But there are lots of other drugs with lots of bad outcomes. There are also sort of social consequences, which I think are important. So for example, law enforcement wants to stop the supply of drugs. And to do that, they need to pull people over and ask them if they have drugs. And so, you can see consequences at the individual level, but you can also see them at the societal level where people are, if you're black, driving while black is an issue because of drugs and people trying to stop the supply of drugs. It's not because of violence. And so there are consequences there too that are, they're sort of very far-reaching. So in my class, we talk about the individual consequences, but much more the social consequences, which are fairly problematic. The judicial system's messed up, right? you're in jail without bail, you're getting things confiscated, So there are lots of sort of consequences when it comes to law enforcement and the law, so.
If I can drill down on the individual level, again, the way I'm thinking about this is mostly, as you can maybe guess, is driven by cultural media portrayals. So the way I'm thinking about this is, after like rampant drug use, or maybe when a person is addicted to a substance, maybe what I kind of imagine is like, if he has a family, the family breaks down, you know, relationships break down, person is not available, moody, you know, trouble focusing per se, financial issues, you know, spending a lot of money and time on just getting access to these drugs. How much of this is like, is this like a, if not majority, but at least a, I don't know, like a decent amount or significant amount of the, is this a scenario which a lot of people do actually face? Or is this like, again, a caricature of what really happens and the truth is much far from?
Well, I think it's fairly accurate. I mean, you know, what happens essentially is that once a person starts using it, and that sort of becomes the focus of their life in maintaining their sort of use patterns over long periods of time, if they have a substance use disorder, I wouldn't say necessarily that they're, that what happens is that their social life changes. It, you know, and it changes in some degree the way you're talking about, right? Their family, there are going to be family issues, there are going to be all kinds of problems, but they also become part of other social networks, right? So they become more close to other people who are using drugs. And so it's not like they become social isolates, which is portrayed in lots of movies, like they're sitting in a home alone in their room. That's not what's happening. They are interacting, but they are just interacting in a whole new social environment. They have new friends, quote unquote friends, are people who are using. And so, and they support each other. I mean, not in necessarily a positive way, right? But they support each other getting drugs and dealing with the system. And so in some ways, yes, that portrayal is accurate, but in other ways it's not, because they are actually forming social bonds. It's just with other people who are using.
Earlier, you also mentioned how most of these stories don't have a good ending, like how most of these, like as opposed to media portrayals. Can you maybe talk a little bit about that in the sense, like, what do you mean when you say most of these stories are like really bad and like they do not have like a that character arc where, you know, one day you use a lot, you bottom out, then there is a change that happens, and then you go on to lead this amazing new life with like a hot girlfriend and maybe, I don't know.
Right. Well, I think that we have to remember who, you know, so the story arc is that you sort of, you know, everybody disowns you and you sort of pull yourself up and go to sort of drug treatment and sort of work it all out. And, you know, part of the challenge there is that, you know, we're dealing with people who might have multiple problems. They might be depressed. They might have anxiety disorder. They might have, and they have, on top of that, they have substance use disorder. And so that's that. So there are challenges in sort of dealing with that. But, you know, a lot of times I think that they lose their social support system. And that makes it very hard to sort of be successful, right? So they have a new set of friends, and those friends don't support them going to treatment necessarily. And so I think it's a challenge for people that way, is that they have to sort of do it on their own. And they don't have a lot of resources, right? They've just spent all the... One of the things that you can tell when I do interviews with people and go to their homes is that a lot of times they don't have anything in their house. Their house might have a couch and a chair. And that's because they've literally pawned everything in their house. They've you know, either sold it or pawned it or traded it for money or drugs or whatever. And so that's kind of like what their life is that they don't have a lot of resources. And now you're asking them to go into treatment and do all these things and, you know, go to work. And, you know, it's a very, I think, challenging, you know, set of to-do items.
Yeah. You know, when you mentioned that you, when you go to their houses, it's generally, it's, I don't know, a couch or a chair or something, yeah, because they've pawned everything else. Yeah. I find that really... weird in the sense, like, I cannot think of another example or another emotion. Like, I was trying to think of a scenario where somebody is so madly in love with this girl or with this guy that in order to take them to dates and to keep them happy or buy them presents, they start pawning off.
Right.
I have never heard of that incident, nor in any other context where I've heard of people either for education, you know, people are pawning off stuff and, you know, they've sold everything for education or for health. I have not heard a single case of that happening, but in terms of like drugs, it just seems like people are willing to do anything to get that. It seems really weird.
It's really true. It becomes, that's how I talk about it, as really becoming your world. I mean, they call it the life when you're in this situation. They call it the life, and this is the life. Is the first and the last thing you think about are the drugs. So, you know, you have to. This is why choice, I think, is a complicated term here, because they don't feel like they have a choice. They have to meet the requirements. You know, that's just what they have to do. Just like you have to go to work in the morning, you know, or you have to take out the trash, or you know, you have to do these things.
Want to touch on gender. I'm like, off the top of my head, I just feel like men just end up using like more drugs than women. Is that fair? Or just feels like?
Yeah, well, it's sort of, well, gender and race, what's interesting about them is that what they found is that people men and women, black, white, Hispanic, they all use around the same amount. No one's using more. Blacks don't use more drugs than whites. Women don't necessarily use, men use slightly more than women, but not significantly. What's interesting is that the consequences tend to end up affecting black people much more than they do whites. And they end up affecting women much more maybe than they do men, because women can get pregnant and have kids, and that's problematic if you're a drug addict. And so I don't think the frequency or the amount of drugs different groups are using is all that different, but the consequences sure can be. So same with poverty is another example. Poor people don't use more drugs than rich people, but they get busted a lot more than rich people do, because they can't afford to just get out of it, right? At least in the US. If you get arrested in the US with a drug charge, you can bond out, just pay a bond, or then maybe you plead down your case with a lawyer, and it's not on your record because you have money to pay a lawyer to do that. If you're poor, you don't have any of that, and so you're either going to go to treatment or jail, and if you fail a treatment, you're going to go to jail. So, you know, so there are a lot of outcomes based on those demographics that reinforce what we think about drug use.
But if I understood you correctly, you're saying, broadly speaking, rich people and poor people end up using the same amount of drugs. Is that fair?
I mean, I think what ends up happening is that the rich people who end up using every day, single day, become poor people. But the people who are using drugs or start using drugs, I guess I should, maybe that's a better way to state it. It doesn't really matter. You can have money, you can not have money. You can have a family full of people who are drug addicts, and that's gonna change. Maybe you have some genetic predisposition, but that's not required. You can come from a good home. You know, there's no sort of one thing that's gonna sort of indicate that necessarily.
So the data is not like, so the jury is still out, is it? In the sense, like, I think for alcoholism, if I'm not wrong, I think there's a certain genetic component, or at least I think there is some correlation between if your dad is an alcoholic or if you have an alcoholic in the family, there's a higher probability that you will end up alcoholic or you will have issues with alcohol. But with the drug use, there's not like hard evidence, is it?
There is. It's about, I think it accounts for about 30% of the variance or so, I think. I'm not sure exactly on that figure, but that doesn't necessarily, but that's somewhat misleading in that people who don't have a family history then think they aren't going to get addicted. Right. So, and that's not true. So,
but their probability of getting addicted will be significantly lower than, let's say, if my dad was addicted to one of the drugs, then I mean, I would be more
A better way to put it would be that a person with a family history has a higher probability than a person who doesn't. I wouldn't say that person who doesn't have a family history has a low to no probability. I think that wouldn't be accurate.
Okay. My math is very bad, so I didn't understand that statement.
No. I mean, I think I would just frame it that way. I think we're probably saying the same thing. Okay. But that's how I would frame it, yeah.
I want to move on to recovery, actually. So we started off with access, and we started off with motivations, like why would somebody want to consume drugs. Then we moved on to accessibility, affordability. We spoke about what have consequences. We spoke about story arcs as well, bad endings. And now at that point, like if somebody is really tired, or I think at one point, I mean, I also feel like sometimes it's also not their choice, right? I mean, nothing is their choice in the sense that, like, if I can imagine a scenario where if I was a drug addict, let's say cocaine addict, then even if I didn't want to not be an addict, my family would probably force me to, I don't know, join a rehab. How should we think about recovery? What happens in that recovery process? Do people recover?
Yeah. So I think recovery is challenging because of a couple of things. First of all, that a lot of times it's not it's forced on people based on their circumstances, either from their family pressure or maybe from the police, right? If they get arrested, they can go to treatment or jail. And I'm not necessarily saying that that's bad. The problem with it is that it's probably not going to be successful. So, so how do we change the scene here? Well, if we give more resources to treatment centers and allow people, there are lots of rules associated with drug treatment. So, for example, if you go into drug treatment and you're unsuccessful, then you can't just go back. You have to wait. There's a waiting period before you can go back. So sometimes when people are in drug treatment, they might mess up and they might use. And sometimes when that happens, they're kicked out of treatment. So I think there are ways to imagine treatment being more flexible in how they interact with their clients. Drug treatment, the whole notion is that you should be completely drug free, as that's the success. Well, maybe they can move people down from using every single day to maybe using once a week. That, to me, would be a success, but it wouldn't be the treatment. So I think there are lots of things like this that might be very hard for people to wrap their head around in the treatment community that might be helpful, because it's very challenging for a person. If you imagine yourself going into drug treatment, they want to change who you are and everything about you. And you might not be interested in that. So I think it's hard that way as well, where they want to reprogram you. And they tell you you're a bad person. And, they reinforce some of this stuff too. So,
Right. I mean, in the sense that because there is some defect in you, you have ended up making this choice. And they want to get to the root of that character issue, is it? Like, is that fair to say?
Right. And sometimes there is a problem. I'm not saying that there isn't. That isn't. But some other times, a lot of the people that I work with, they have a lot going on, but they have a lot going on as a consequence of their use. It's not necessarily like they're really bad people in the first place, right? So I think treatment. Sort of emphasizes all these things you're doing as a bad drug user, and so that's hard for a lot of people to hear when they might not imagine themselves as a bad person, because in fact they aren't. so So I think there's some challenges there too. You know, this sort of tough love kind of notion. I'm not sure if that works for a lot of people.
That character defect, like that speech seems more for me, I feel like the most, like the analogy I can think of is like religious conversions, which happen maybe like, you know, like how people might say, like you have some issue with you and we have found the correct, we have found the right God and, you know, you should come with us. And, you know, it feels like that for me. But
Well, I mean, a lot of them have do have religious undertones, right? From Alcoholics Anonymous, now, you know, searching for a higher power to sort of get through this. And I mean, I'm some people, that's great for them. I don't want to dissuade people from going in treatment and finding a higher power to get past some of these. That's fine. But other people, I was actually, it was interesting. I was talking to someone, this was years ago, but he was like, well, I'm Muslim. And this the whole sort of scene was so sort of Christ oriented that I couldn't stay in treatment. And it just blew me away that they didn't have some sort of way to accommodate sort of other religious beliefs maybe in the context of their treatment. Now, I'm sure that's changed now, but the mixing religion and drug treatment, I'm not sure if that's wise. So,
oh really? Yeah. Because like intuitively, like I would think that how I'm thinking about like the notion of surrendering, right? I feel like you know, they just surrender to that, to whatever God that they believe in, and then like at least I've heard that talk a lot. I think generally as well. I think that's why religion sells pretty well, in the sense that no matter what problem you have, if you surrender to your God, okay, it ends up working for you. And some people really do buy into that, and I have sometimes I have genuinely seen a lot of like good change because of that. Whether you know,
I'm not disagreeing with you, but I'm just saying that, let's say that you don't believe in God, right? So it makes it hard for that to happen. So, and you know, maybe you're a drug addict and you've been a drug addict for 30 years. And so the whole concept of God might be a little bit foreign to you, or, you know, and so I think that might be a hard sell. I mean, you can still, you know, think of other ways to maybe get your therapeutic message across other than surrender to a higher power. So I think that it's just trying to fit those paradigms into the lives of people is challenging.
That's all I have for you.
Okay. Yeah.
Is there anything I have? Is there anything important that I've obviously forgotten to bring up multiple things? But is there anything very important that I have forgotten to bring that you would like to maybe touch on? Or
I mean, no, not really. I mean, for the most, I have to say that one of the reasons why I've stayed in this business for so long are actually the people that I meet. You know, and I tell students this, and it's, I think it's hard for them to wrap their head around this, but most of the people that I meet they're in circumstances that sometimes make them bad people or harsh people. But for the most part, the people that I work with are good people. And I think it's really hard because of all of the socialization we have around drug users being bad people and needing to be punished. It's hard to get past that, to imagine them as just regular people. So, and I think that that's really a challenge. And I work in harm reduction because harm reduction imagines people who use illegal drugs as people with lives and hopes and dreams and things like, and just for regular people. And so that's a very different way to imagine this community than how it's imagined by law enforcement, the treatment that a lot of times people in treatment, or the medical community, right? So I think that that goes a long way to having conversations with people in these situations when you treat them respectfully and like people and empathetically. And so I think there's a disconnect there in policy that needs to be corrected. I think Europe does a much better job, of course, and Canada than the U.S. ever does on these matters. But I think that that's missing, at least in policy, is this notion that actually, you know what, they're just people trying to make it who are addicted to drugs. It's not like they're the demon that we make them out to be, or that they're going to suck your blood or right or kill your kids or something. You know, I think there's a lot of there's so much layering that sometimes it's hard. And I think even in research, you know, it's not like I'm doing research on cancer patients, and you know, that's sort of a noble thing. I'm researching people who other people don't really care about, which is sort of sad. So yeah.
I think earlier you mentioned you were in this field. You've been in this field for about 40 years.
Anything
that stands out? Like, I mean, is there anything? I mean.
You know, I mean, I wish, you know, it's interesting. People are really, my students are really interested in the real story of addiction, because I think they get so much false information, you know, from TV shows and from maybe their parents or maybe the police that come to their schools and educate them that, I think that would be that I like teaching the class primarily, and I don't teach it as an educational, I don't teach it like a don't do drugs class. I just tell them what the data show and what my experience has been working in the field. And inevitably, at the end of the class, I always have one or two students saying, I really appreciate this because now I'm not going to use drugs, even though that wasn't the point of my class. And so I think that's important. People are free to do whatever. In fact, I'm not saying that drugs are even bad in my class. Some drugs are fine. And if people want to use drugs on the weekend, that's fine by me too. I don't have any problems with it. But people need to realize that you just being interested in trying cocaine, you know, that can be challenging. You know, there can be issues there. Maybe you do it again, and maybe you do it. So I know it's a weird. I think it's an interesting topic, because this issue of choice that you bring up, I think, is a good one. That would help.
Any drug that you haven't tried that you would love to try before you die?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I think that you know, this is an interesting thing. Is that with hallucinogens, a lot of the researchers use drugs and they talk about their experiences. But you can't do that with the other illegal drugs. So I don't know. One of the things I do is we watch people inject drugs, to understand what they do. And a lot of times people say, well, don't you want to try? You want to try it? Or have you been interested? And I'll have to say, you know, no, because I've seen just the shit lives of the people as a consequence of the use. I just can't get, I know I'd probably like it for starters, but you know, the consequences are just too hardcore for me to, I feel too bad for the people, even though they don't want my pity or anything like that, but they're in bad situations. So, yeah. So to answer your question, no, I guess a wrong way, but yeah.
Thank you so much for your time.